This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today we're checking in with our public media reporters around the state to hear about their most recent work and talk about some of the biggest takeaways. With us now is Rebecca Thiel, environment and energy issues reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting, to find out about an Indiana medical device manufacturer emitting cancer-causing chemicals in the air and locals not being informed about it. Rebecca, what exactly is ethylene oxide and why should we be concerned about it?
Yeah, so it's a widely used chemical to sterilize medical equipment, spices, and other things. In 2016, the EPA actually classified it as a known carcinogen and a very potent one. You know, just a little bit of this chemical can cause some big damage. And most notably, you know, there are lots of symptoms, both, you know, if you only get exposed a short time or a longer time. But it's been linked to certain blood cancers and breast cancer in women.
Why is it that the residents of Ellettsville are just now hearing that they've been exposed to ethylene oxide from the Cook plant?
So environmental agencies usually inform the industries that use this chemical, but there doesn't really seem to be a protocol for how to let residents know. You know, the EPA says it was the Indiana Department of Environmental Management's job. But on the other hand, an activist and former EPA official I talked to said the EPA has more resources in the states, so they really should have been the one to take the lead and communicate with residents. Bottom line is, you know, no one really made sure that residents know.
Well, how did you find out what was going on in Ellettsville?
That's a funny story. So I was actually buying a house in the area. And, you know, all the time I speak with so many people who say, I didn't know this pollution or contamination was here when I moved in. So I really wanted to show our audience how you can do that kind of legwork yourself to some extent. And while I was trying to do that, I came across this higher cancer risk in Ellettsville in 2014. I really didn't expect to see it.
Wow. And so when you found that information, can I ask where you found that and were able to see that the cancer rates were higher?
Sure. That was on the National Air Toxics Assessment. It's something the EPA has a little map of on their website. And we can talk a little bit later about some ways you can find that on our different station websites.
Are ethylene oxide emissions a larger issue around the country? I know that I've heard of, there was a plant in Illinois where there was ethylene oxide, and I think they shut it down. I don't want to misspeak, but, you know, residents were finding out that they had cancer and such. So is this something that we're seeing everywhere and not just in Indiana?
Yes, and you're right. That plant in Illinois did shut down. There are a couple of others in Illinois also. There have been protests about this. There have been lawsuits over this. You know, you mentioned the shutdown. Really, in some ways, people in Ellettsville are actually a little bit lucky. There are plants such as in Verona, Missouri, for example, that have much higher ethylene oxide emissions than the Cook plant. So it really is a countrywide problem.
What is the federal government doing to reduce ethylene oxide emissions?
So right now, the EPA is working to develop more strict rules about how much plants like Cook can emit. They're also working to make it so more industrial plants have to report those emissions to the EPA. So we actually might find out that there are more of these facilities in Indiana than what we once thought. On a separate note, the Food and Drug Administration is also looking into alternatives for ethylene oxide. So what else can these really important companies that make things like medical devices use to sterilize their products? That research could take several years, though.
That's interesting, just to think that there should be some alternative to ethylene oxide. And I'm wondering, like, why is it now that people are looking into this versus like 10, 20 years ago? But when you've spoken with residents in Ellettsville, what has the reaction been?
So this is mostly based just off of social media and what response we've seen there. I think a lot of people are shocked, and they're really trying to process what this means for them and their family. I should say Cook did send a letter to its employees before the story aired, which did have a lot of the same information that we had in the story, but it also essentially said that people in Ellettsville were safe. You know, if you read the story, the levels are lower now, and I do hope that that's true, that it is safe for Ellettsville residents now. But it's clear that neither the EPA nor IDEM is really checking these emissions numbers and doing their own monitoring. So I think it's important that we find out whether or not that's true.
It must be scary, you know, to find out that somewhere where you've been living all these years is actually harmful. One of the shocking things you found out about this is that the Environmental Protection Agency allowed Cook to change its emissions numbers after the fact. What are the implications of that?
Right. Well, you know, the EPA has said that it does allow industries to change these numbers, usually based off of better data, better ways to find out what those emissions are. But the fact that they're not really checking and making sure those numbers are right, you know, having that independent person looking over that data, you know, basically they're allowing industries to rewrite their history. And if you don't know how much these companies are emitting, how can you know what the risk is to you and your family?
Has this always been the case that these industries are able to put the numbers out that they want? Or is this a change that we've seen in the last couple of years?
You know, I'm really not sure. This isn't something that I knew about. I have always known, and many people do, that industry is allowed, they are basically the ones who give the EPA their initial emissions data. So they report to either IDEM or the EPA. And usually, you know, unless there seems to be a problem, the EPA or IDEM may not check up on those numbers. But I really wasn't aware that once that companies could request this change, first off, and that once they did, there wasn't necessarily that accountability to check up on them when they want them to be changed.
Is it fair to say that there's just a serious lack of accountability and communication and negligence behind the scenes with the EPA and these companies?
You know, I think that it's fair to say that there needs to be some kind of protocol, I guess, to make sure that this information gets to residents. Obviously, if you are the EPA, if you're IDEM, you might say it should have been the other agency's job, or maybe it should have been the job of a city official. Sometimes city officials can look over this data. They're sent that information by the EPA. So I think that it's really, you know, we have to sit down and say, how can we make sure that residents know? Not just say there are these agencies that should be letting residents know.
What has the response been to your story from listeners, from folks at the EPA, perhaps?
Well, I haven't gotten a lot of response from the EPA or IDEM or even Cook, really. I think that they sent out their letter and they sort of felt like they said what they needed to say, even though I should say that all of these agencies didn't do an on-camera interview with us. And, you know, there's a lot that we were surprised about in terms of communications to us as journalists in trying to find out what we felt like was a very important pieces of information to pass along to residents. So, but there's, to answer your question, a lot of residents, you know, as I said, have kind of expressed this shock. And then I think Cook employees are kind of trying to figure out who they believe and what they, how they feel about the company.
Is there anything being done right now to address the ethylene oxide emissions in Ellettsville?
So we're just kind of in the early stages. People are just figuring out that this is something that happened. Town Councilman William Ellis, which we spoke to for the story, has expressed a lot of interest in bringing the EPA to do a presentation for Ellettsville residents. I think that that's something that should happen. And then we should really figure out more from the EPA about what the risk actually is and what these emissions really are.
For folks who want to learn about potential exposure to dangerous chemicals in their area, where can they go to find out more? And I know you mentioned a website earlier.
Yeah, or a web page, I should say. I've actually compiled a lot of information that I've gathered over the years into a web page that we've posted a couple of times, and hopefully we can post again so people can look at it with this new National Air Toxics Assessment also added, where you can really figure out, okay, what are the sources of pollution in my community? Where are the hazardous waste sites, for example? And how can I actually go about figuring out what the risk is to me? And then there are also some information that I put in there about how to test, say, for lead in your home and things like that. And I think that probably as we go through, as I go through my career, I'm going to be adding to this more and more so people can really do their homework themselves.
Before we wrap up, do you think people are more aware and concerned about these types of things out in the environment that they're being exposed to than in the past?
I really think so. I think that, and I'm not sure what it is in particular, but we've got a lot of things that we're thinking about, right? We're thinking about the climate. We're thinking about environmental justice. We're thinking about how pollution affects health more than I think what we were before. So I think that this is definitely a trend that we're going to see where more people are going to be asking what's around me and what can it do to my health and the health of the people that I love.
Thank you so much. Rebecca Thiel is an environment and energy issues reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. We'll be back after a quick break. We'll be joined by our workforce development reporter to talk about Indiana filing lawsuits against federal vaccine mandates. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today, we're doing a check-in with public media reporters from across the state to learn about their latest work and take a closer look at their stories. With us now is Justin Hicks, workforce development reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. He's going to give us the latest on Indiana's lawsuits against federal vaccine mandates. Justin, what are the requirements the federal government announced last week for vaccinations?
Yeah, so these were pretty expected requirements that were coming down the pipeline, and we'd had hints along the way what was happening, but we finally got roughly 500 or so pages of legalese telling us exactly what will happen under this new emergency temporary standard. So the federal government is telling employers who have 100 or more employees that they'll need to require vaccination or weekly testing for their employees, along with masking if they do not get vaccinated. So it's a really big, carrot and stick kind of scenario here. That's essentially saying, listen, we really want people to get vaccinated, and we're going to make that happen. So that's the requirement. OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, is the agency that is sort of charged with overseeing this. And that is because this is an OSHA order. It's an OSHA emergency temporary standard, which typically you would see if there was sort of an emergency situation or maybe, you know, a lot of companies were using a particular chemical that was harming people. OSHA might find out, oh my gosh, like this chemical is not good for people. We need to do something about this right away. And that's where your emergency temporary standards come from. So it's come in the form of that. And we'll see what happens.
So to be clear, the federal vaccine mandate affects only companies with a certain number of employees.
Yes. So companies with 100 or more employees. And one weird quirk of this as well is that states look at workplace safety. Their OSHA agencies come in two categories. One category is they'll have offices that are run essentially by the federal OSHA. And then other states have what they call state plans, which essentially is where the state has said, we're going to have our own independent state agency. However, we're going to follow federal OSHA rules. And the rules for those are typically the general requirement is that the states have to be at least as effective, which most people interpret as restrictive, right? But they have to do at least what the federal government tells them to do. They can do more if they want to, but they have to at least follow federal OSHA guidelines. So Indiana is a state plan. And so because of that, that means that Indiana's state plan covers public agencies as well as private agencies. So if they make a rule for private agencies, public agencies have to follow that as well. So here in Indiana, it'll mean that it affects not only private employers with 100 or more employees, but public employers with 100 or more employees as well. So that's, you know, police departments, schools, notably, any local government that has over, you know, 100 employees will be affected by this in Indiana.
What's been the response so far for this vaccine mandate? I mean, I've heard from other states, or I've seen that, for example, entire police forces are not wanting to get vaccinated, even though it's being mandated. What's happening here in Indiana?
Yes, I mean, the response to this mandate has been, I mean, largely, it really just falls on political lines. It's exactly what you would expect. Many conservative states who have said that they did not like this are lining up and suing immediately. So, you know, Indiana is one of the many states, conservative states, that's doing this, you know, along with Texas and Louisiana and Florida and Arkansas, I believe. I mean, there's a whole list that I could go on and on. So, I mean, essentially, it breaks down political lines. If there are people who politically do not agree with sort of these decisions being thrown down by the federal government, they don't like this mandate. If you have people who politically are a little bit more friendly to federal government authority, you know, it's typically your Democrats or, you know, I don't want to paint a broad brush there, but, you know, those folks are in favor of this, and they see this as a way to really make sure that people are getting vaccinated and that we can kind of end this health crisis more effectively.
Are politicians vaccinated? I'm curious if this mandate is in order, does that mean they have to be vaccinated to be in the assembly or other quarters?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I'm not sure, because I'm not entirely sure if politicians, I mean, obviously they get like a stipend, you know, for their work, you know, but I'm not sure if that would be considered employees. For the work that they do. So that's actually a really good question. I'm not sure. I haven't heard anything like that, that it would affect politicians and what they do and don't have to do. But I'm not sure. It's a great question.
I'm also just curious, because I'm thinking if these folks are jumping on suing and all of these other things, but are they vaccinated themselves? So just my own curiosity.
Yeah, no, it's a great question.
What would you say are the consequences? Have they labeled what the consequences are for employees who don't comply with these vaccine requirements?
Yes. So for employees that don't comply with vaccine requirements, they would have to get tested weekly, and they would have to wear masks at work. So, and by the way, I should say too, I mean, another kind of financial consequence of this as well is that it's not like the federal government has said, you know, oh yeah, you know, we're going to pay for all the testing. In many cases, they're saying either the employer would have to pay or the employee might have to pay for that testing. So there, I mean, there could be a little bit of a financial hit there as well for someone who decides not to get vaccinated. If your employer says, yeah, we're not going to pay for that, you should have gotten vaccinated. So, you know, in weekly testing, that's, if you're in, you know, if you're going to Walgreens and buying the, what are they, like $30, $20 tests, you know, that adds up really quickly. So,
yeah, that would be very pricey. And I mean, there are places that do free testing, but I wonder if it's a specific criteria of a type of test that you have to have taken regularly.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I should say too, one other natural consequence as well could be that you just get fired. Indiana and many other states have at-will employment, meaning you can get fired for a lot less, you know, that, you know, the law says that employers don't really have to give you a reason for firing you. So, you know, that could be something we see more of too, just people losing jobs because of that, because they don't want to get vaccinated. I don't want to overstate that too much though, because I know that has become a political talking point as well that I'm trying to stay out of, where, you know, conservatives, Republicans have really said, well, no, this is going to hurt the economy because look at all these people who are going to get fired or are going to quit voluntarily because of this. We don't know if that's going to happen. So I'm trying to be very careful around that, but it could be a consequence.
Speaking of consequences, what about for companies that don't want to comply and say, you know what, we're going to let our employees decide if they want to be vaccinated or not. We're not going to check up on them. What would be a penalty for them?
Yeah. So OSHA is, you know, kind of the Teddy Roosevelt motto, speak softly, but carry a big stick. That is the OSHA way. Because this is an OSHA standard, they have built in fines that can be assessed if you don't follow the standards. So companies can get fined. Oh my gosh, how much was it? Let me look this up. They can get fined several thousand dollars for any one violation of the, you know, of the COVID thing, of the COVID mandate. But if they are shown to be willingly, you know, belligerently sort of against this, right, they could be fined up to like $135,000, essentially, if you can show proof that this company said, yeah, we know what the mandate is, we're just not going to do it. That's a big penalty right there.
It seems like it's a lot of businesses to keep track of, and companies and these records of whether folks are vaccinated or doing weekly testing. Have they mentioned at all what kind of a system or is this sort of like undercover boss type thing where it's like you might get checked up on or you might not?
Yeah, I mean, I think they are requiring that employers keep these records, but I think they're being pretty flexible on that, you know, and employers keep records on employees all the time, right? I mean, your name and your social security number and things that they have to do to pay you. So, I mean, you know, we all have a file at work. So they're saying, listen, you can keep these records the way that you want, but here are certain things that we will require you to kind of track. One of those things, by the way, is they will require sort of a proof of vaccination. You can't just come in and say, it's not good enough for this federal requirement to come in and say, I'm vaccinated, trust me. You have to show proof. And that is one of the things that's written in. So companies will have to track this stuff in their own way. And then the way that OSHA works essentially is, you know, you can either get randomly checked in on, which happens rather rarely, simply because OSHA agencies are typically much, much smaller than the amount of employers in the state. So it's, you know, it's really hard for them to fairly randomly check in on people. But what does happen more often is that if an employee complains, files a formal complaint with OSHA and says, hey, you know, my employer is not following what they're supposed to be doing, OSHA will come out and they will investigate that complaint. And if that happens and they find that everything's not in the up and up, you can get in some pretty big trouble.
Is there any concern about counterfeit vaccine cards? I know when they've opened up concerts and other types of venues where people were required to show proof, that kind of came up in some concerns, and it was found that some folks were doing that. Is that a concern at all with companies? How are they going to make sure that the information they're getting is right, aside from just trusting their employees?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, like I said, the federal requirement has told companies to check those COVID vaccination cards. You know, if you're not a scrupulous HR manager, though, and you're not really looking very, very closely to make sure that it is a legitimate card, I could definitely see that happening, that you might have some bogus COVID cards coming through and employers saying, oh, yeah, we saw it. It looks real to us. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure that is a concern. I haven't really heard a lot of specific concerns, but I'm sure that HR managers will be charged essentially with trying to make sure that those cards are legitimate.
That's kind of an interesting change and shift for folks in HR to now have to be sort of like the healthcare police checking up on people.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, I mean, I know with a lot of companies in various sectors, HR has been tracking vaccinations for a long time. You know, like when I went to when you go to college, right, and mm-hmm. you have to make sure that you get, you know, the rabies shot and the tetanus shot and the Hep A and B and C, you know, all those other kind of immunizations and vaccinations. I mean, I think HR people are actually pretty used to tracking vaccinations, depending on the industry that you're in. In some industries, though, I can imagine it's not really that much of a conversation. So it could be new for those HR people.
Yeah, and maybe it's something we just never thought about before or had conversations about because, you know, it didn't get to this point.
Yeah.
We're in a pandemic. But earlier you mentioned the weekly testing for employees who don't want to get the vaccine and they may have to, you know, do that out of pocket. Is there anything being done for employers to cover the cost of testing for folks who don't want to get vaccinated, or is it solely on the individual?
Yeah, not to my knowledge. So OSHA did, they kind of had a lot of estimates in their order when they sent it out. They had most of that order, honestly, there was one or two pages of it that were the actual requirements. And then, you know, hundreds and hundreds of pages to sort of justify their rationale for those. And in those hundreds of pages, OSHA did know that this was, you know, it was going to put some sort of cost on employers and potentially employees. They didn't seem to think that it was a significant enough cost to really worry about. If I remember correctly, they kind of said that, you know, for many companies, you know, they had it kind of broken down by sector. And I think for manufacturing, they were like, yeah, you know, for some manufacturing companies, this may cost them, you know, a couple $1,000, $4,000 or $5,000, to comply with this rule. But OSHA didn't seem to think that that was anything to, you know, too big to worry about when you look at the grand scheme of how much money they make. So
you mentioned how Indiana and a number of other states have filed lawsuits related to these vaccine mandates. What is the most common argument that these states are making?
Yeah, so I mean, it kind of runs the gamut, but I think the big philosophical argument that is going on here, which how this compares to a legal argument, I'm not entirely sure. I'm not a legal expert, but the big philosophical argument that comes in here is that this is overreach of the federal government. They're essentially saying, listen, we have state laws. The Constitution grants us the right as states to make laws for our citizens. And the federal government can't just come in willy-nilly and decide, you know, we're gonna regulate this one part of people's lives that the state has always regulated. So, you know, the states are claiming that this is just overreach of federal power. That's probably the most common. Other arguments I've heard and seen, and I didn't see this lined out in Indiana's particular case, but something that they talked about, which I was a little surprised I didn't see in the legal documents, was the feasibility of this. So essentially, you know, when we did a press conference with Todd Rokita, he mentioned and some of his staff mentioned that they thought that it just wasn't feasible for people to get weekly tests, weekly tests right now, simply because if anyone's tried to get tested recently, you'd kind of know there's a little bit of a line and there's a little bit of a wait, and you have to find the right scent, you know, the right place to go. So we just thought it wasn't really feasible. And they thought that maybe that would be an argument against this as well. But I do think overreach, I mean, that's the biggest philosophical argument here.
If the lawsuits are successful in blocking the mandate, what do you think would happen next?
I don't know. I mean, I think the White House would obviously probably try to find another strategy in order to make this happen. And I doubt that they'll simply give up on it. They may just have to find another avenue to make it happen. But I don't see a ton of, you know, legal remedies. And then again, too, I mean, if these lawsuits do defeat this requirement, I don't know if that could be used as perhaps legal precedent to block other avenues from the federal government to enforce any of this stuff. It's a really good question. I'm not sure.
Well, let's look at it also from the other perspective. If these lawsuits aren't successful, what does that mean?
Yeah, I mean, we've already seen one of these lawsuits, you know, get a temporary stay or a temporary sort of injunction on this federal requirement. And that was a lawsuit that was filed with a circuit court in Louisiana, I believe. So we've already seen that that's kind of had this sort of pausing effect on the mandate. I'm not sure. exactly what will happen. I mean, obviously, it'll kind of mean that we'll just kind of be here at the status quo if these lawsuits succeed. It'll mean that there is no federal requirement to get vaccinated, and that, you know, companies could still individually require their employees to get vaccinated because companies have that power generally, but it would mean kind of just more of the same.
Justin Hicks is a workforce development reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're back with our reporter check-in, and now we're going to take a dive into Lee Gaines' most recent work. Lee Gaines is an investigative education reporter for WFYI, and we're going to learn about her latest work on the pandemic's impact on the social and emotional learning of students with special needs and the challenges of navigating the special education system. Lee, welcome to the program. What do we know about how special education students were impacted by the pandemic?
So we have some initial research on this subject that shows that the pandemic may have exacerbated pre-existing achievement gaps between students with and those without disabilities. It's not clear in Indiana how the pandemic has impacted students receiving special education services, but we do have some data that's been made public so far. So we know that, you know, this year, only about 8% of special education students scored proficient in both math and English language arts on this year's iLearn assessment. That's compared to about 32% of general education students. And so that is 3 percentage points less than the most recent standardized exam in 2019. But big caveat here is that Indiana officials say that the data from the 2021 assessment should not be compared to prior years. But we do know that the number of students who received special education services who scored proficient in both those subjects was quite low. We also know that chronic absenteeism has increased among this student population. So roughly 39,000 students with special needs missed 10% or more of school days. That equates to about 18 days over the course of a full academic year. And that's an increase of about 9 percentage points compared to the 2018-19 school year. We also know that fewer students were evaluated for disabilities in the 2019-20 school year, and that the number of preschoolers diagnosed with disabilities dropped more than 11% from last year. So that's a sign that young students might be missing out on important therapies and interventions because they're not being spotted by educators.
Just to clarify a little bit about that with the data, is this due to a lack of educators in the system? I know we've talked about this in the past, that there aren't enough teachers specializing in special education. There's a shortage.
Yes, that is absolutely correct. For years, Indiana, and this is also a national problem, we have been dealing with a shortage of special education teachers. And so it's both, as you mentioned, a pipeline issue in that there aren't enough teachers going into preparation programs who specifically want to focus on special education. And then it's also a retention issue. There are a lot of teachers who become special education teachers, but they don't stay. Or perhaps they switch from teaching special education to teaching general education. You know, as we mentioned before on this program, you're not necessarily going to make more money as a special educator in Indiana.
You had the opportunity to talk to students with disabilities about their experience going to school during the pandemic. What did you hear from them?
Yeah, I spent some time at the Independence Academy, which is a private school in Indianapolis. It's pretty small. They only have about 40 students in grades 4 through 12, and all of their students are on the autism spectrum. And we have a clip of one of those students, Kate, talking about what she experienced during the pandemic when school was closed.
I'm a sophomore and I'm 15 years old and I love the school, except, but not with Zoom. Zoom was not my favorite.
Why didn't you like Zoom?
I just thought being in person is better, just for me, mentally and physically, because I like to be with people. I don't like seeing people on computers.
What have you heard from educators and researchers about how students with disabilities were affected by the pandemic?
So a lot of what I've heard is that they're concerned about academics, but they're really concerned about the social and emotional impacts of the pandemic on this population of students. So what we just heard from Kate is that she really did not like Zoom school. She said for her mental health and her well-being, it was really important for her to be in person. And that's reflected in the research, and that's reflected in the conversations that I've had with educators. So they know that there will be academic implications, of course, across the board, not just for students receiving special education. But what they're really concerned about are the social opportunities and the emotional opportunities that these students lost out on. You know, for a lot of students with disabilities, you know, school might be their primary place to socialize and to learn social skills. And they didn't have any of that while schools were closed. And even when schools reopened, some of the precautions that we had to take to keep everyone safe, you know, with masks, social distancing, that made socializing and learning those skills a little bit harder.
In addition to reporting on the impact of the pandemic on special education, you also worked on a project that highlights common challenges Indiana families face navigating the special education system. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, this is a project that I led, but was really a team effort by folks at WFYI and Indiana Public Broadcasting, where we created a digital storytelling map, essentially. It's like a choose your own adventure. And we highlighted common challenges families face through the experiences of three families who lived it. So three families who've gone through the special education system. And as a user, when you're interacting with this project, it will ask you questions. You say yes or no. And depending on how you answer those questions, you get to read and listen to some of the stories of these families. And you also get the legal context around what schools are supposed to do in these situations and also what rights parents have in these situations.
Oh, that's fascinating. It sounds like it also be a helpful tool for parents navigating that will see that they're not alone in that realm.
Absolutely. That was one of my big goals in doing this project. The inspiration was really, you know, I knew I wanted to focus on special education when I took this job, because we know that these students are especially impacted by the pandemic. We also know that this is an area that doesn't always get a lot of attention in the media. So that's my inspiration for wanting to focus on it. But as I began to read about special education law, both state and federal law, I realized it's this insanely complicated, opaque process that parents have to navigate. So I wanted to create this tool as something that's helpful for them and also something that's engaging, because you're actually seeing people's stories. And so, like you said, yeah, hopefully they know that they're not alone when they face these challenges.
Can you tell us about some of the stories of the parents you featured in this project?
Yeah, we featured three families. One family in particular, Gael, she's a mom. She is an immigrant. She came here from Haiti when she was quite young. And so she talked a lot about how she didn't really understand how the education system in the U.S. worked. And she didn't know how it worked in Indiana. And she had no experience with special education, which is its own complicated thing, as I mentioned. And so she has a daughter named Kimberly, and she started noticing that Kimberly was not learning her ABCs or how to count properly, despite, you know, going over that information in school, going over it at home. And so she eventually, you know, got her daughter evaluated for special education services. And we have a clip of her talking about what it was like when the school came back and said that her daughter was not eligible for special education.
Overall, I walked out of that meeting feeling defeated. By the time I walked out, I didn't even make it to my car yet, and I was crying. I was crying because I didn't feel ganged up on, but at the meeting, after they told me about her scores and why she didn't qualify, they were telling me all of these things that I could do with my daughter to help her. Not the things that they could do for her, but the things that I could do for her.
What did Gael do next to help her daughter get access to special education?
So she ended up reaching out to an advocacy organization called About Special Kids, and they hooked her up with an advocate who was able to help her understand like what her rights are in this process, and who was also able to attend meetings with the school to discuss her daughter's progress and, you know, her access to special education services. And as a result, she was able to get her daughter reevaluated for special education. And at this point, the school said, okay, yep, she is eligible. And obviously Gael was really happy about that, but she was also really frustrated because she was like, you know, nothing changed with my daughter in this time. So why was it that, you know, initially she wasn't eligible, and now all of a sudden when I come armed with information and an advocate, she is eligible for these services? And that's not an uncommon experience. I've heard from multiple families who've gone through similar situations.
If you're listening and want to get in on the conversation or just get in touch with us, you can send us your questions and comments via Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Lee Gaines, investigative education reporter for WFYI, to learn about her latest work on the pandemic's impact on the social and emotional learning of students with special needs and the challenges of navigating the special education system. Lee, you also featured the story of a parent named Brandy and her son, Caden. Can you tell us a little bit about the obstacles they faced while navigating the special education system?
Yeah, Brandy and Caden are, in my opinion, kind of an example of the worst case scenario, in that, Brandy's son, Caden, is on the autism spectrum, but he didn't get diagnosed until he was in elementary school, and he was denied repeatedly for special education services. And so his mom, Brandy, had to go through the legal processes. Basically, what happens when schools and parents disagree over special education, there's a number of processes that they can take to try and resolve those disputes. And eventually, by the time Caden was in high school, he was having some disciplinary issues at school. He was arrested multiple times for situations that were, you know, related to his disability. He was acting in a way because of his disability. And at one point, the school district tried to place him in a residential setting, which was terrifying to Brandy because she thought, this is not going to help him. This is just going to make all of his issues worse. This is going to be the worst possible thing for him. So she ended up having to get an attorney, and she went through a due process proceeding, which is basically a civil court proceeding in education. And the administrative hearing officer in that proceeding ended up siding with Brandy. But then the school district appealed. It went to federal court, and the court sided with her. And, you know, eventually the whole thing was settled. But this was a years long process. We're talking about a single mom, too. You know, she has a son with a disability. She's trying to get him the services he needs. And she basically went through hell to do that. And we have a clip of her talking about, you know, that experience and what it was like for her.
And not everybody is in a position that I was in. Like, it was hard, but I was also lucky. I know that that sounds asinine, but I was lucky. I've met people with the work that I do that people are just railroaded because they don't have access. They don't know what to do. They're tired. Like, they're more behind the eight ball than what I was.
Are there any systemic issues when it comes to navigating the special education system?
I mean, as we mentioned before, there appears to be a lack of special education teachers, and that makes it hard for families and students to get the services that they need. I also think the way that the system is designed, like I said, it's really hard to understand what you're entitled to, what your rights are as a parent. And for me, you know, my full-time job is to understand complicated things and to, you know, distill that information so that it's easily digestible. And if I'm struggling to understand this system, and this is my whole job, then I can't imagine what that's like for families who have full-time jobs, they have family responsibilities, maybe they have more than one job, for them to navigate this process. So in a lot of ways, I think one of the biggest problems is just lack of understanding, lack of knowledge, and schools that know that they are in positions of power here. They have the information, they have the resources, they have the staff, and parents don't have any of that. So the deck often seems stacked against parents in these situations.
Is there a certain type of criteria families have to meet in order to receive special education assistance? And is that part of the problem that those who make these decisions may not deem a family qualified?
Yes, there are. So all of this is included in a federal law called the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. And there are certain disabilities that entitle children to special education services. But even if you, you know, let's say you have a child who's diagnosed with autism by a physician, the parents have to prove, or the school has to evaluate the child and find that that disability impacts their ability to learn in school. So it's not a given that if your child is diagnosed with a disability, even if that's a qualifying disability, that they're automatically going to receive special education services, because the school is going to do their own evaluation to see if that disability interferes with the child's ability to learn. But essentially what everyone is entitled to, the purpose of that law, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, the spirit of it is that every child, no matter, you know, their disability status, should have access to a free and appropriate public education. But they're, you know, like I said, when the law in practice, it doesn't always work out that way for families, unfortunately.
Is there some sort of incentive for schools to cut back on special education funding? Like, are they able to take that funding and put it somewhere else?
No, special education funding that comes from the federal government needs to be used for that purpose. But something that special education administrators are quick to tell you is that the federal government has never fully funded the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, so that schools, you know, they do receive a certain amount of money every year, depending on the number of children they have who receive special education services from the federal government, but they'll tell you it's not enough, that they end up having to use, you know, their own other non-federal resources to make up the gap, because the federal government has never done, you know, has never really picked up their fair share of the cost of educating students with disabilities.
What do you hope people take away from this project?
Well, like I said, and you mentioned, I really hope that families who have a child with a student, or have a child with a disability, that they know that they're not alone, that there's many families out there who, you know, every family is different, but they're all navigating a system. And a lot of them are coming up against these obstacles and barriers. And I also hope that people who, you know, don't have children with disabilities, people who don't have children at all, take a look at this project so that they can understand, you know, this crazy complicated system. Because as taxpayers, you know, we should all understand this. A lot of taxpayer money goes into special education, and it's important that we understand how it's functioning or it's not functioning. So at the end of the day, I hope everyone takes a look at this and that they come away with some tools, not only to advocate for themselves, but to advocate for each other.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Lee Gaines is an investigative education reporter for WFYI. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.